Welcome to Rants and Reason. I am Chuck.
I am Karen.
I used to be a Democrat.
And I used to be a Republican.
I'm still a liberal.
I'm still a conservative. But other than that, we're not really sure what we are. But we do know this. As Abraham Lincoln reminds us, we're not enemies. We're friends.
We're friends. How are you doing, Karen?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I am doing good. You did a lot of work on this one.
Yeah, I tried to. So we're going to get into our second in our series of suspected voter fraud of elections in the U.S. And last week, we looked at the history of voting, and we cited some very specific and somewhat dramatic examples of voter fraud. But now we're going to take a look at the claims of election tampering from both the left and the right, and then we're going to try to parse out a little bit of truth.
That's right. Now let's start with the claims from the right. Wah, 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 wah.
And there are many.
And some are valid, but most are not. I've yet to find any that are, but we're going to cover this anyway. Now, reports of voter fraud abound from the political right, and these reports are the basis for much of the election voting-related legislation we have going on in states. So we're going to look at the main accusations of fraud. Now, here's the interesting thing. The Heritage Foundation, a very conservative, very right-wing, wouldn't you say, Karen?
Yeah, they're definitely more conservative think tank.
Mm-hmm. And they're very concerned with voter fraud.
Almost militantly concerned.
Insanely
they have a database
concerned.
Tracking them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like when the Heritage Foundation goes to bed at night, they look under their bed for in their
voter
closets
fraud.
For voter fraud. Yeah.
The voter fraud monster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they only found roughly 1,200 proven instances of voter fraud.
Right. Actually, less than 1,200, but yes.
Mm-hmm. You did the research on this, so I guess I should provide a good number. 1,178 proven
instances
of voter fraud.
Well, I was just saying that you were actually giving it a little bit of extra room, so that's why I pointed it out.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Now, 1,028 of those resulted in criminal convictions. Now, 138 million people voted in the 2016 elections. That means the proven cases of fraud make up exactly 0.00085% of votes. One in a million. Roughly
right.
One in a million.
Right. Well, the president has persistently claimed that there's widespread voter fraud, and he even created a commission to investigate it. And that commission leaned heavily on a report to back up his assertion. And the report was a Government Accountability Institute study, which just happened to be released about 2 months after the president had formed his commission. The 36-page report, which you can find on the White House website, claims to have identified 8,400 cases of double voting in the 2016 election. And they base this on data from 75 million voters from 21 states. The nonprofit said that it compared lists of people who voted in different states and identified duplicates by matching their names, birth dates, and a portion of their social security number. Virtual DBS, the firm contracted to crunch the data for the report, said that its methodology would result in, quote unquote, virtually zero false positives. However, experts who worked with government officials on the electoral system actually claim that the study suffered from a glaring vulnerability that can often result from large data sets. This vulnerability is that rare instances of human error occur in large sets of numbers, millions of data points that grow exponentially when multiplied against one another. They could manifest as what might appear to be a significant number of matches, if not examined closely. Small mistakes, like people signing the wrong line of a voter roster, or errors as paper sign-ins are computerized later, are kind of part of the voting system, and out of 75 million voters, the errors could add up. For a study to be credible, it would need to account for this by calculating a rate of which these types of false positives were occurring, and then adjusting the results accordingly. Nonetheless, the president put together his commission to research the fraud, but less than a full year later, the commission was disbanded, and Charles Herndon, White House Director of Information Technology, said in a sworn court declaration in federal court that the Voter Fraud Commission, quote, did not create any preliminary findings, end of quotes. But if this is still a major source of concern for you, let's look at what makes up the claims of fraud and why.
Well, let's talk about absentee ballot fraud, Karen. Now, absentee ballot fraud is what comprises the bulk of voter fraud.
Right.
Now, even the left-leaning Slate admits this. Although, again, in the overall scheme of things, the total amount of convictable fraud is way, way, way less than 1%. But here's the issue regarding absentee ballot fraud. Republicans haven't put through any election reforms that target this problem. Why? Because guess who benefits from absentee voting?
Right. Republicans are the ones to statistically benefit from it. Mm-hmm. Well, now we're going to get into voter registration fraud. Although there's actually very little statistical evidence of specific registration fraud, the system does have many problems that need to be dealt with. And many of these problems can be taken out of context and pretty easily reframed to kind of affirm a whole fraud narrative. A 2002 Pew study outlined many of the issues. So approximately 24 million, one out of every eight, voter registrations in the United States are no longer valid or are significantly inaccurate. More than 1.8 million deceased individuals are listed as voters. Approximately 2.5 million people have registrations in more than one state.
Hold on.
Yes.
Before we get on that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how hard it is to get your name taken off a voter roll in a state?
Oh, I'm sure it's really difficult.
Yeah, the boys moved to Illinois, and Tanner and Ted, they both changed, so their registration will be up there, so they could vote up there. And Tanner got a card for jury duty. And then they asked him why he did not take himself off the voter rolls.
Mm-hmm. He's like, I tried to.
Yeah, he told him, I did. Mm-hmm. In Illinois, and they said, well, you can't be registered two places. And he said, well, I tried to do it, and you know, I did it. I took myself off the rolls.
I don't understand why that's not done with a change of address card. It seems to me that that would be the easiest way to do it, that when you do your change of address with the post office, that you mark a box with the, you know, to take you off the rolls or put you on the new one. I don't understand. But 12 million records contained incorrect addresses. And one thing to consider when we talk about this problem is the cost of it. One study by Pew spotlighted Oregon and found that state and local taxpayers actually spent $4.11 per active voter to process registrations and maintain the voter list, or $7.67 per transaction. So contrast this with Canada, which uses a more modern technology to register people, as well as data matching techniques that are common in the private sector. They actually spend less than 35 cents per voter to process the registrations.
You know, Canada seems to be so far ahead of us in so many things. I mean, look at like that. Mm-hmm. You know, 35 cents versus $7.67 transaction.
Per transaction for per person on the roll, it would be $4.11. Yeah.
And their helicopters fly in the rain.
Excellent point.
For those who missed that is a shot at our president not going to the ceremony on Veterans Day.
I'm sure that they can figure that out. Our okay. listeners are very smart people.
They are, but I just...
Smarter than I us, like that one. Actually.
Yeah, they are, actually. We don't set a real high bar. Well, Pew suggests a three-point plan to combat these issues. Now, this is Pew Research, not Pepe Le Pew. Now,
right. And these aren't our suggestions. This is what Pew suggests.
This is what Pew came up
with. I'm a little uncomfortable having online registrations. Personally, I think that opens up some vulnerabilities. But moving on.
I think we should just use Facebook because everybody's on Facebook.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea. That couldn't be hacked at all. Nope.
Well, that's where everybody gets their information, so they might as well vote through Facebook. Yeah. Just however many likes each candidate gets, that's who should be president.
That's kind of like that's the new version of your stoning method that you discussed last week.
Exactly, yeah.
It's like the modern day version of the Monty Python method.
Yeah. Well, here's their three-point plan. As you compare voter registration lists with a wider array of data sources, actually including Facebook, to broaden the base of information used to update and verify voter rolls. And you use proven matching techniques and data security protocols to attain the level of integrity and confidence needed to ensure accuracy and privacy. And thirdly, you establish new means for voters to submit information online and minimize manual data entry, which results in lower costs and fewer errors. So basically, what we need is an updated registration system more than we do a more stringent system or more stringent laws. Voter requirements are just adding fuel to a fire that's already starting to rage out of control. That was nice wording there, Karen.
Thank you. Thank
that was
you.
Nice prose.
Okay, so is it data? Okay, it's data? That's how you say it? Data?
Data.
Data.
Yeah, unless you're from Florida or Oklahoma.
Well,
you say data.
I go in between. Data. Sometimes I say data and sometimes I say data. Yeah, but neither like, one is what you say, right? You say.
What was baby's first words? Data.
Data. Yeah. Well, I mean, I say data or I say data, but I don't ever say, what is it that you say?
Data.
Data. Data.
Data.
All right. Are you sure that's correct or is it just the Chuck Walters version?
I am 100% sure.
Okay. All right. Well, now I know. Now we're going to kind of talk about ineligible voters, which are the felons, which they are now eligible in Florida, non-citizens, multiple voting, and those that impersonate. So we're going to go into a little bit more of those people later too. But a comprehensive 2014 study that was referred to in the Washington Post found 31 credible instances of impersonation fraud from 2000 to 2014. So that's, let me repeat that, 31 out of more than a billion ballots cast.
31 over 14 years, yep. Which is roughly 2 per year. That yeah. wasn't even worth doing a study on.
So even this tiny number is likely inflated because the study's author did not count just prosecutions or convictions, but any and all credible claims. So this is impersonation, right? Impersonation fraud. Not all of those, not ineligible voters total, but impersonation.
We literally have more credible alien abductions than we do in-person voter fraud.
Right. Right. Okay. So two studies done at Arizona State University, one in 2012 and another in 2016, found similarly negligible rates of impersonation fraud. The project found 10 cases of voter impersonation nationwide from 2000 to 2012. The follow-up study, which looked for fraud specifically in states where politicians have argued that fraud is a pernicious problem, found 0 successful prosecutions for impersonation in 5 states from 2012 to 2016. After the 2016 election, the New York Times surveyed election and law enforcement officials in 49 states and the District of Columbia. They learned of 2 possible instances of non-citizens voting, and this is out of 137.7 million voters nationwide.
Well, that's why we need the wall, Karen, to keep those 2 non-citizen voters out.
News 21, an investigative reporting project, based at Arizona State University, reviewed all reporting instances of voter fraud from 2000 to 2012. They found 56 cases of alleged non-citizen voting. Even assuming that all of these allegations are true and all of these non-citizens voted in 2016, that would total approximately 0.00004% of all ballots cast. That would be four zeros. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a ton.
Yeah.
That'll sway an election.
In 2012, at the request of the governor, Florida's Secretary of State set out to purge the state's voter rolls of non-citizens. Out of 12 million registered active voters, officials claim to have found 180,000 potential non-citizens. Yet, after all the errors on that list were uncovered, only 85 names were removed from the rolls as alleged non-citizens, and only one person was actually convicted of fraud.
You know, when people are talking about voting irregularities,
mm-hmm.
Florida should not even be able to look up from the ground.
Right.
I mean, they're literally still counting, but every election we have, it's like, well, hopefully by Thanksgiving, we'll know what Florida did.
Well, Florida single-handedly ruined the name Chad.
They did. Yeah. But I mean, how can Florida mess things up every single time?
I don't know. It's
every
amazing.
Single time. It's incompetence that really you couldn't replicate if you tried.
Well,
every time Florida has an election, it takes 6 weeks to get them back.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
And the big question to me, to the Florida Secretary of State, is how did these 180,000 non-citizens
get
on the rolls to begin with?
Yeah.
And if this were a big problem, don't you think politicians would be pandering to non-citizens?
Yeah.
I'm going after the independents and the non-citizens.
Right.
That's my base.
Right. So in 2012, Michigan's Secretary of State claimed that as many as 4,000 non-citizens were registered to vote. In the end, only 10 people were referred to the state attorney general for further investigation because they had voted. Now, I would be willing to guess that most of the websites or news articles that you see that cite voter fraud on the right, or, you know, news magazines from the right that cite a lot of voter fraud, I bet they use the numbers like 180,000 and 4,000 without the end result, just
right, that's
what the officials claim.
Read, yeah.
Right. So just because something says officials claim, make sure you look up the end result of what the officials claim, because there could be a lot more to the story. So also in 2012, Colorado's Secretary of State claimed that 11,805 non-citizens were registered to vote. But ultimately, just like the others, the state identified just 35 individuals on the rolls who were allegedly non-citizens and had voted.
Did they just pick somebody with by like last name? Like, oh, that doesn't sound like an American to me. And just, that could be a non-citizen.
I don't know.
If you're not named Smith, Jones, Walters, you're just put on that thing.
I don't know what the process was to determine a non-citizen, but.
Well, let's talk about in-person fraud. Karen, okay. Now this is the catalyst for the voter ID laws we have. Voter ID laws target only one form of voter fraud, in-person impersonation. Now, I know this happens because when I was voting in this election, there was a man behind me and I went up to the table and got my ballot. And then he came up behind me and said he was Groucho Marx and had a little cigar and a little. So it's impersonation, people impersonating other people.
You're so weird.
I don't know why that made me think of that. Well, see, you can't prevent double voting by a person who votes in their own name because that doesn't involve impersonation.
Right.
And you can't prevent tampering with already cast ballots or voting machines or counting methods.
Right. Or absentee ballots either.
Or absentee ballots. Right. You can't. So the claim then is not that ID requirements eliminate fraud, just that they reduce it. Now, in absence of concrete evidence of substantial in-person fraud, the argument is that lack of statistics does not defeat the case for voter ID requirements. And this is much what I say at work when people ask me what I do. I say I prevent us from dragon attacks. That's my job, is to prevent dragon attacks at work. And people look at me kind of weird, and I say, when is the last time you've been attacked by a dragon? Just say thank you. So, now, proponents still have two defenses. First, they claim correctly that the failure to observe fraud does not mean that no fraud takes place.
I mean, there's a little bit of truth to that, but I would say it's just a little bit. I mean, just because you don't see it doesn't mean it's not there. But obviously, I think you need pretty firm statistics to be able to enact legislation. But
yeah, and really, when you're talking about fraud, we don't seem to care much about fraud anyway. We see it all the time.
Yeah.
But successful fraud would never come to light, is their reasoning. So it's not certain that in-person impersonation fraud is so rare. Now, secondly, this kind of fraud, even if rare, violates law and can turn an election in just the right circumstances. So better to have less fraud than more. Just like better to have less dragons than more. So the main question to ask now is whether the potential for fraud is worth the cost. And is there really even a cost?
Right. Well, okay, here's what I think. It's really possible that much of the right's assertions and just complete fear of voter fraud have a true origin way back in Tammany Hall, the Democratic political machine that dominated New York City from 1854 to 1934. It was really well known for its reputation for electoral corruption. Many of the urban areas of the early 1900s were ran by Democrats and were rife with corruption. Political scientists estimate that in many of these areas, fixtures routinely manipulated 10 to 15% of the votes. A study by the Brookings Institution that looked back on U.S. elections in the 19th century observed that indifference, fraud, corruption, and violence have marked the operation of our electoral system. So here's, you know, I really think that much like racism, one generation handed down their mistrust and worldview to their children, who handed it to their children, and the cycle just perpetuated. It just kept continuing. It just kept continuing. I just made up a word.
Continuating. It's a continuating thing here.
It's a continuating process. Yeah. So, I mean, that's really what I think. I think that, you know, there was a seed of truth at some point, and then it just became a myth. It became a legend, and it's no longer true. Statistics don't bear it out, but it is so true in the minds of so many people because their parents believed it, and their parents believed it, and their parents believed it. And so that honestly, that's what I think. That's why I think it's just so strong in the minds of so many Republicans. But let's take a look at the other side of the aisle, Chuck.
Well, the left likes to scream about voter suppression, Karen.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
they do.
Not like the kind of suppression where there's actual gunfire, like we talked about last week.
Right, or poison salad bars.
Yeah, poison salad. That was a good one. That was a good plan. Now, one need not search long before running into a ton of reports online regarding incidences of voter suppression due to voter ID laws. Now, these reports don't always correlate with actual requirements and exemptions of the reported state. So, basically, people are saying that we're making it much harder to vote than it really truly is. And I have to admit to being not completely informed about Ohio as I was ranting and you decided to get online and prove me wrong. You took great joy in that, but I think
I didn't. That's not, well, okay, I took a little bit of joy in it. I was very surprised at what we found when we actually looked up true facts instead of other people's opinions. It's amazing what you learn when you look up facts, but
it kind of is. I hate being wrong like that, though. And well, you know what I hate worse about it?
For like 3 days.
Well, you just took so much joy in it. You brought it up every time we talked.
I think I was very graceful about it, but I mean, you just wouldn't respond. I was like, what do you think? What are your thoughts on that? No comment.
No, you were like, every time we talked, you were like, you ready to vote? Do you have your ID? Well, if you don't have your ID, you know, you can just take your gas and electric bill. If you don't have your ID, you can take this. If you don't have your ID, you can take that.
I did not do that.
Every conversation.
You were just so inflamed about it, just so angry, and it just took all the air out of your balloon.
It was righteous indignation.
It was.
I hate when people kill my righteous indignation.
Like I take a little pinprick and it's just, yeah.
Now I just got to sit in a chair like. Well, although there is much ado about voter ID laws, Karen, the truth is, for the most part, and I'm going to borrow one of your terms here, it is kind of a big nothing burger, just like the purported fraud claimed by the right. Now, when we take a close look at each state's voter ID laws, the strictest states have a multitude of accommodations, such as applying for a voter ID, bringing in any state documentation of residency, or even an expired driver's license. Now, one example of manipulative reporting on this matter is a news report from usually a very reputable source that said that a voter ID law requiring an address targeted native people in specific areas, but neglected to mention the fact that tribal ID cards sufficed, as well as expired licenses or a utility bill. And there are multiple forms of ID allowed. And here's one thing that I really get hung up on. Working for the government and the job that I have, you always hear this thing that it disenfranchises poor people, making them have IDs. And the poorest of the poor people are who I see all the time. They can't get any government assistance without an ID.
Right. Actually, kind of encouraging them to get IDs helps them get jobs, helps them propel them forward. So I think if there weren't exceptions available, it would definitely disenfranchise people. But there really are a lot more exceptions than I thought there were. And I didn't realize that expired licenses were acceptable in most circumstances. I mean, people have to have a photo ID to get an R-rated movie ticket. You know, when you think of it that way, it's not too much to ask. True.
You know, Taylor, one of the twins, goes to see movies all the time, and he still gets carded, and it just drives him crazy.
Right. I mean, you have to show a photo ID to get alcohol, to get cigarettes, to get movie tickets. Why not to vote? I don't think it's too much to ask. I just think there should definitely be exceptions for those who don't. And really, the people that I think get affected the most are senior citizens, because a lot of times, you know, they just have no need for it anymore. So if anybody gets disenfranchised, I think that's the group, because it's not easy for them to get out and just get a regular ID, you know. So,
you know what always amazed me? This is kind of on a personal note. My mother did not drive.
Mm-hmm.
She never had a state ID.
Wow.
Ever.
Wow.
And my whole life, she never had a state ID. And she would write checks and do all kinds of stuff. Never had
So here's my question. It says a photo ID, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does Costco count?
I don't know.
I just wonder. Okay. So the biggest criticism of voter ID laws is that they discourage voting. But is this really true? Voter ID laws can depress lawful votes in theory, but do they do it in practice? Columbia Law Review states that some studies suggest the answer is no. They find little or no effect on voter turnout. And that might actually make sense, because people burdened by ID requirements may tend to be the people who couldn't or wouldn't vote anyway. Other studies suggest that voter ID laws do depress votes. Basically, you can cherry pick a study to fit your narrative, but really no one knows for sure. One study that I found incredibly interesting was out of Michigan State University, and it presented evidence that there may even be a counterbalance effect that voter ID laws inspire people to vote, possibly even increasing voter turnout. Like election fraud, much of the statistical evidence is anecdotal and missing full context. Because most states have a multitude of identification options, it appears that the reported cases of suppression often happen at the local level. Poll volunteers are either not trained well in the nuance of identification requirements, or they utilize their power in order to achieve their bias. It's really hard to know for sure unless each incident is studied.
I'll tell you, you ain't lying about the poll workers, man. You give them a little bit of power, it goes to their head.
Right. There definitely has to be equal representation when it comes to the people working at the polls.
Yes. Now let's talk about culling, Karen.
All right.
Culling is when you just chop people off the knees so they can't even get into the voting station because they have no feet. So, now, as we can see from the registration issues we talked about earlier, culling actually is very necessary. I mean, you can't just have people from 1876 on your voting registry.
Right.
And in 1993, the National Voter Registration Act mandated that state and local elections officers keep voter registration lists accurate by removing the names of people who die, that seems reasonable to me, move, not so reasonable, or fail in successive elections to vote. See, that doesn't seem reasonable to me either. I don't like that one.
Right. And now, again, when was this act?
It was Clinton did it, but okay. It was a Republicans in Congress that pushed it. So anyway, voters who have been convicted of a felony typically can't vote. In Florida, they can now. People who are ruled mentally incompetent. Now, that's ruled mentally incompetent, not just mentally incompetent, because I know when I went to the voting booth, at least 75% of the people there were mentally incompetent
They might have thought the same of you, though. They might have been looking at you going, God, these mentally incompetent people are voting. Mm-hmm.
What is that movie you love so much, Karen?
Idiocracy.
That's what I felt like. I mean, people running up and like jamming their paper into the scanner backwards and everything else, pouring slushies in it.
Why won't it work?
And the other group of people who are called are non-citizens. Now, the U.S. Election Assistance Commission reported that 15 million names were scrubbed from the list nationally in 2014. One of the more controversial methods of deciding what name should be called is from a cross-referencing system known as, tell me, Karen.
Crosscheck.
Crosscheck analyzes data from different sources and verifies username, date of birth, and the last four digits of a social security to flag duplicate registrations for deletion. Now, a report from Rolling Stone claimed Crosscheck targeted minority communities. But a Harvard study revealed that Crosscheck was not created to be foolproof.
I think we amuse ourselves more than anything.
Yeah, more than our listeners. It's just a cool name. Crosscheck.
But okay.
Crosscheck was not created to be foolproof, and the culling decisions lay with local election commissions.
Right, that's key right there.
So a few safeguards that would lessen the controversy surrounding culling. If it only flagged registrations where the Social Security was mismatched along with either a name or date of birth. In other words, the social should be the defining factor in this.
Right, not just the name, because people go by so many variations of their name. Take myself, for example.
Yeah, well, so. And people... you know, that have hyphenated names. If they don't match exactly, they were taking them off. Now, election commissioners make several, one of the suggestions, election commissioners make several attempts to contact the registrant before culling. And the other thing that should happen, it should only happen in the year prior to an election. You shouldn't be culling people 3 weeks before an election.
Right, especially when your opponent starts to surge in the polls and all of a sudden it's necessary to cull the registration list. I mean, that's so shady. You're just asking for people to think you're up to something when that happens.
When you're the Secretary of State running for governor.
And you're like, oh, time to cull.
We have no eligible voters in Atlanta. So, And the other suggestion is, and Ohio has this, is a state online or 1-800 number or text options that you can check and see if you are registered to vote.
Right. And, you know, your right to vote has to be important enough to you for you to want to do that. I think that that's something people forget. It's like, you can't force some, you can, it's the whole, you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. You know, sometimes if people want to have the right to vote, they need to be responsible enough to make sure that it's there. I mean, calling a 1-800 number or texting to find out, or just checking online to make sure it's good before you go to the polling station, that's really not that difficult. I mean, if you don't have access to the internet or you don't have it on your phone, you can go to a local library and look. I mean, there are things that you could do for most people to be able to figure it out,
but,
if they are.
But still. Karen, do you know what you need at the local library to use a computer?
A library card.
An ID. You need an ID to get a library card.
That is true. That's a good point, Chuck.
That's reader suppression is what it is. It's literacy suppression.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. It's librarian's fault.
Now we're going to get into your favorite subject.
Well, if you lived in my congressional district, you would be very familiar with this, Karen.
I understand. I just think that it's not as... It is partisan now, but I think it would be partisan given the other circumstance as well. But I definitely agree with you that it is a problem. And we are discussing gerrymandering. This refers to the drawing of district lines, whether for Congress or for state legislatures, in order to give one party numeric advantage over the other. This section really refers to math a lot, so it makes me feel very anxious. This technique is as old as the United States itself. In 1788, Founding Father Patrick Henry tried to gerrymander arch foe James Madison out of the first federal Congress.
Yeah, I wonder how he did that. Did he say, like, oh, Virginia's not really a state? I mean, I never figured out how he tried to do that.
I don't really know that works, yeah. As the saying goes, it's not the voters choosing their representatives. It's the representatives choosing their voters. The origin of the word gerrymander was a combination of salamander and the last name of Elbridge Gerry, who, as a governor of Massachusetts in 1812, signed into law a redistricting plan designed to benefit his political party, which was a Democratic Republican. So
both sides
it was
do
both.
It.
Both sides, yes. Gerrymandering harms democracy. By way of mathematical trickery, that's just, you know, that mathematical trickery would get me very quickly.
Mathematical trickery to you is just trying to figure out how much change you should get back.
Just give me an algebra problem and I'm like, mathematical trickery. It's a witch.
It's a witch.
Burn the witch. Okay. But using that, a party can lock out rivals from being able to achieve a majority. Mathematical trickery such as packing and cracking. In packing, you're taking as many voters on the rival side as you can and cramming them into as few districts as possible. Cracking refers
it's
to...
It's cracking, Karen. Cracking.
Packing and cracking.
Yeah.
Why can't you... You use a fake Southern accent 90% of the time. You won't let me do it?
Okay,
good grief. All right. Cracking refers to spreading voters as thinly as you can across as many districts as possible. Remember, margin of victory doesn't really matter because the winner takes all. 50% plus one is enough.
Now, let's see how skewed things can get with gerrymandering. Take these battleground states. Pennsylvania, which they had to redraw the maps in Pennsylvania this year and look at the huge turnover they had. But in 2012, Republicans got 49% of the vote, less than half. Yet they took 13 out of 18 seats in the House of Representatives, 72%. In Ohio, where literally you could not, if you gave someone a big thing of clay and said, hey, create Chuck's district, it would take them like 11 hours. Republicans won just a little bit over half of the vote, but took 12 out of 16 House seats. 75%. And what they do, I'm a classic example of cracking. Cincinnati is very, very heavily Democratic. So what they do is they split Cincinnati right in half. And then they add all these rural areas to the west and to the east. So we're District 1 and District 2. So it's just so bogus. Anyway, the most notorious of all, though, is North Carolina. In 2016, Republicans, again, won less than half of the votes, but took control of 10 of 13 House seats, 77%. Now, the Brennan Center for Justice estimates extreme partisan bias gave Republicans at least 16 to 17 more seats in the 2016 election and possibly as many as 29, according to one analysis. Democrats were 24 seats short of controlling the House.
So if you went by most of the analysts, the Republicans would have had it anyway, but that one analysis, they wouldn't have. So,
well,
that's just slightly manipulative.
Slightly
way of putting it. No, I'm saying the way that was written made it sound like it was definitely, it would have gone to the Democrats had it not been for gerrymandering, but there was really only one analysis that showed that the numbers were that high. That's all I'm saying. I'm just pointing that out. Okay.
Could have happened.
So how is this legal? Well, for the most part, courts have tended to leave it up to the states to engineer the maps. A few states, including California, Arizona, and Montana, have independent commissions for redistricting, much like, again, in Canada.
See, why can't we be more like Canada?
The Supreme Court justices have said that gerrymandering can, in theory, be so extreme as to be unconstitutional. The problem is how to tell when that line is crossed. So in recent years, mapping software has really been a game changer. The Wisconsin legislative map that was drawn in 2010 targets voters with really almost surgical precision. It virtually locked out Democrats from controlling the House. And academic experts say that 2010 redistricting was the most extreme in the nation's history. That's because of two factors. There was a stark partisan imbalance in control of state legislatures and governorships, and new computer technology that made it possible to draw extremely fine-tuned partisan borders. Yeah. And remember, I mean, this was the Obama midterms.
Right. So that's when the Republicans really came in and just swept everything. Right. And so it was time to redraw maps. The Republicans were in control of everything, and they had software that could tell them what streets were Republican. You know, so that's how they made the districts.
Well, all of this brings us to one Supreme Court case, and that's Gill versus Whitford. In 2010, for the first time in over 40 years, Wisconsin voters elected a Republican majority in the state assembly and the Senate, as well as a Republican governor. And as a result, the Republican leadership developed a voting district map that its drafters calculated would allow the Republicans to maintain a majority under any likely voting scenario. Plaintiffs in the case, they challenged the plan, saying it was unconstitutional partisan gerrymandering. And what the issue was whether the plan systematically diluted the voting strength of Democratic voters statewide. These were the questions in the case. Did the district court err in holding that it had the authority to hear a statewide challenge to Wisconsin's redistricting plan rather than requiring a district-by-district analysis? Did the district court err in holding that the redistricting plan was an unconstitutional gerrymander? Did the district court use an incorrect test for a gerrymander? Are defendants entitled to present evidence that they would have prevailed under the gerrymander test actually used by the district court? And are partisan gerrymandering claims justiciable? The decision indicated that the plaintiffs failed to demonstrate Article 3 standing, so there was no need to resolve any of the questions presented. In an unanimous decision authored by Chief Justice John Roberts, the court actually sidestepped all of the key issues regarding partisan gerrymandering and resolved the case instead on the technical issue of judicial standing.
Now, I think what we're going to see a lot more of is initiatives, state initiatives. We just introduced one in Ohio that in 2020, an independent commission will redraw all the maps. So that was on the ballot.
Okay.
So that's, I think that's where it's going to lead.
Right. That's where people need to take back their powers through the states.
But. Right. And that was kind of an interesting one because there were 12 defendants and they said, you don't live in all the counties and all the districts. Mm-hmm. So you can't be harmed. You know, you can't speak for those people. So you have no standing.
Right.
Well, has the Supreme Court intervened before, Karen, you ask? It has put discriminatory racial gerrymandering out of constitutional bounds. Now, that's a kind of gerrymandering that was found in North Carolina when the map diluted the power of black voters. And true, it's true. Do you know what North Carolina argued?
What?
They weren't trying to dilute black voters. They were trying to dilute Democrats. That was their actual argument in court.
Wow.
Well, because the courts found only on a basis of race, many states believed that they could just go to town on party-based gerrymandering so long as they could prove it wasn't race-motivated. And it's so bad, this guy David Lewis, a North Carolina state representative, a guy who led remapping after the Supreme Court said, you have to remap, he said, I propose that we draw the maps to give a partisan advantage to 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats, because I do not believe it's possible to draw a map with 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're just that blatant about it.
Yeah.
And it's also important to note that the U.S. is one of a very, very small group of countries that allows its politicians to draw election maps. It's pretty much what we do here is like if you let your kids decide which homework they would do and what time they would go to bed.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If the kids got to make the rules on what they have for dinner, what time they went to bed, that's letting politicians draw maps. It's the same thing.
Right.
Obviously, gerrymandering is one of the most legitimate grievances regarding election influence. But we have found that most of the indignant rumblings of fraud regarding everything else was less substance and more framing.
And speaking of framing, that's what we're going to look at next week. We're going to really expose the surprising practices of political marketing and what we can do to free ourselves from it, because it is really, really manipulative. And we're also going to pinpoint the major problem that no one really talked about this last midterm, which was cyber espionage,
right.
You know, cyber hacking. It's a real issue, and it's something that needs to be discussed and that we very much that gets lost in the fray when we're talking about partisan fraud, that, we're talking about something that doesn't exist.
We get caught up in all these arguments and we don't even think about how our elections are actually influenced in a fraudulent nature.
Right. Exactly. So that's what we're going to talk about next week.
But for now, that is all we have to say about that.
We want to thank everybody who takes the time to listen to us, those that share us, or those that take the time to leave us a positive review. You can find the show on all the standard podcast platforms, and we would really, really love it if you would join us at Rants and Reason Facebook group, on Instagram at Rants and Reason, or on Twitter at Rants Reason.
And we want to give a special thank you to our Patreon supporters. We really can't adequately express what your support means to us. So thank you so much.
Yes, we really appreciate all of you. And we hope that you all have a wonderful, wonderful Thanksgiving.
We do. Thank you. Bye, everybody.
Bye.